October 7th was not a result of the rage that we have. It was a result of our arrogance and our complacency and our overconfidence and our total disregard and disrespect to the ability of the Palestinians.
Welcome to a candid conversation on Palestine, Israel, and Europe. Our guest today is the former Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert. In this episode, he joins the director of the Candid Foundation and editor-in-chief of Zenit magazine, Daniel Gerlach, to discuss the aftermath of October 7 and the future of Israeli-Palestinian peace.
Prime Minister Ehud Olmert, thank you very much for being here in Berlin. Thank you for joining us at the Epicon podcast, a candid conversation about Israel and Palestine and about the role that the Europeans can also play in bringing back the peace process. So I would like to ask you first, how is it possible and how could it be possible to bring the peace process, to bring peace back on the agenda of domestic politics in Israel?
Well, obviously, it has to depend largely on the policy of a government. The present government seems not to be interested, certainly not as a first priority, in making peace with the Palestinians. And my judgment is that the forces that make up this government presently will not change their attitude. So the only way to turn into a peace policy is to change the government, which is what we want. If there will be a different government, there is a likelihood, not a certainty, but a likelihood that there will be a policy of peace.
But can't the government at the moment claim to be speaking on behalf of many Israelis? They even say that they're speaking on behalf of the majority who reject Palestinian statehood, who believe that peace is never going to be possible. We see the behavior of the liberal Zionist parties in Israel who are also not campaigning on this issue at all. What does it take, like also emotionally, politically, for the Israeli electorate to see really an option in coming back to the table?
Well, Israel is now in the process of recuperating from the trauma of the 7th of October. 7th of October was traumatic by historical proportions. Not just to those who traditionally were against Palestinians and against any compromise with Palestinians or against any genuine open heart discussion with the Palestinians. I'm talking about those like me that were on the other side, that understood that rapprochement, that a serious negotiating process with the Palestinians is inevitable. It's in the interest of the State of Israel. And many of them lost their trust in the ability to discuss genuinely and openly with the Palestinians a solution on the basis of some kind of an agreement, two states, compromises, and so on and so forth. And this was heartbreaking, a terrible, terrible trauma. Now, I think we are starting, not yet fully, of course, partly, to think about, okay, already we defeated all of the, what the Prime Minister called the seven fronts, the Hezbollah, Syria, the Iranian militias in Syria, the Iranian militias in Baghdad, in Iraq, the Houthis, the Iran itself, and so on. And Hamas, of course, in Gaza. So what is the future? What can we do or should we do that will create the beginning? I'm not talking about already ideal, comprehensive solution forever. I'm talking about beginning a process that hopefully will lead Israel one day to a different attitude with the Palestinians and a beginning of trust and a genuine dialogue and something that will hopefully bring an end to this violent historic conflict that costed so much to them and to us.
I mean, you're one of the, or probably at the moment, the most prominent voice and face of a two-state solution initiative of peace building. You often appear in public with a Palestinian friend, a Palestinian counterpart, Dr. Sure. Nas al-Qudwa, who is the former foreign minister of the Palestinian Authority, the nephew of Yasser Arafat. He's your friend and you often appear together. What about the Palestinian side? Who are your, who are the people you talk to? Who are the people that you can engage with in such a process?
Look, not all the Palestinians are Hamas. And without drawing a comparison, not all the Israelis are Ben Gvir and Smotrich, or Bibi for that matter. So there are quite a few Palestinians that are absolutely worthy of a dialogue and of trust. They also are not now exposed in their full strength and numbers because of obvious reasons, because also amongst the Palestinians, the devastation that they went through, the number of people that were killed, the destruction in such a massive proportion, has created a certain attitude now, emotional attitude, that has to be overcome, just as with us. But there are many Palestinians that are worthy counterparts, that are prepared to talk, that are ready to understand the need for a dramatic compromise on both sides. And they are good partners. And we have to reach out. We have, look, again, if we will not remember what President Biden told us at the beginning, he said we will be victims of the rage that obviously we all felt. If we let ourselves be consumed by this rage, we'll never be able to pull out from there into a better, more somewhat balanced and responsible look at the future.
Is this what happened?
We have to do it.
Is this what happened after October 7? Is like the destruction, the massive number of casualties, the killing, just a result of rage? Because it's very difficult to fathom that, the idea that an entire nation could be, out of emotional reasons, capable of such a response, of such a massive onslaught.
Well, of course, the October 7th was not a result of the rage that we have. It was a result of our arrogance and our complacency and our overconfidence and our total disregard and disrespect to the ability of the Palestinians. And the fact that it was also part of a strategy which was adopted by the Israeli government for years and years, when the Israeli government, after I retired, I negotiated with them in a serious manner. We were very close to conclude an historic deal. They failed. They didn't have the guts, the courage, the inspiration, the broad leadership that would force them to sign. Okay? But since then, Netanyahu took over, and he, as a matter of policy, didn't want to embark on serious negotiations towards peace. So he ignored completely the Palestinian Authority, and he moved into a crooked, distorted dialogue with the Palestinians. And the basis of this dialogue was, we'll give you money, we will allow you to tighten your control on Gaza, which is, even if not said, but in practical terms, this is the only way you can interpret it. And you will not attack us. The Palestinians, the Gazans, the Hamas in Gaza, was more than happy to receive all the financial support that came as a result of the Israeli approval. Otherwise, it couldn't come from Qatar, hundreds of millions of dollars, which helped them build the infrastructure for their military operation. And then they attacked Israel. So the attack against Israel was not a result of the rage of Israel. It was a result of the arrogance and the complacency and the total inability to understand what motivates these radical fundamentalist extremist organizations.
But rage was an important element of the response, the reaction.
The rage was, of course, the...
And that's what I would like to probe you on. Of course, you are a politician, but you have a legal background also, but you are a member of your society. It's difficult for us to understand.
The reaction lost the reasonable parameters of what can be done and to what extent it can be done. I thought, and I said it, I wrote it, a year and a half before, that the time has arrived for a conclusion of the military operation and an agreement that will bring back the hostages and will allow the end of the war and the pulling out of Israel from Gaza. I thought so, and I haven't changed my mind that the agreement was actually signed now in beginning of October, because it could have been done a year and a half before. In fact, if you will look at this joint statement made by me and Dr. Nasser Kidwa on the 17th of July 2024, which was 15 months almost before the agreement, you'll see the same, basically the same parameters, the same basic lines of policy that were suggested by us that are now the 20 points of President Trump. Could have been done before. What was needed was just one thing, giving an order to Netanyahu to stop. And the fact is that when Trump gave him an order to stop, he stopped. He could have made this order at least on the 20th, since the 20th of January 2024, when he took over the White House.
Why didn't the Americans follow up on that? I talked to a few negotiators who said the Americans at one point, you know, paddled back from their own text and they wanted to open the package again. They wanted to discuss the phasing and they basically lost interest in safeguarding the deal. What happened?
I wish I could be the spokesperson for the American administration, but I'm not. I really don't know. As far as President Trump is concerned, and everything starts with him, everything evolves around him. He is making a decision every 10 minutes, and he tweets it, and it becomes an international event of the utmost importance, and everyone follows up. Do you know what he wants? Does he know what he wants? Is he fully aware of all the complexities and the histories and the sensitivities and the desires of the parties involved? I doubt it very much. So how can I explain the Americans? I can only say that there was no reason why they didn't force Netanyahu into what they forced him to at the end, much earlier.
You're now in Europe and you come often to Europe. What we hear a lot in Israel, but also in other parts of the region, is Europe's voice doesn't matter. Europe is out of the game. Europe is not a negotiator. Europe doesn't speak with a united voice. Europe has no leverage over the situation. Now we have President Macron, who jointly with the Saudis, and I believe you supported this initiative, came up with this alliance for the two-state solution. Some of the text also made it into the American papers. What is it for you that Europe can do, and why, if, is Europe relevant in all of this?
Europe is relevant to the degree that it wants to be. But potentially, it's very relevant. Europe is, first of all, the largest trade partner of Israel. We're making mutual trade, in the tens of billions of dollars every year. And this is huge. This is enormously important for the Israeli economy. And also politically, European countries are Israeli partners. Germany, one couldn't think of a better friend to the state of Israel on almost every aspect of life than Germany throughout. I mean, this is not just now at the time of Chancellor Merz. It was with Scholz. And it was with the chancellors before, of course, you know, Angela Merkel. Who can match Angela Merkel in terms of her dedication and involvement, support, sensitivity, broad understanding, strategy about the relations with the state of Israel, and this enormous significance of the relations between Israel and Germany. I had the privilege of working with Angela Merkel. I admire this lady, and I don't normally say that about political leaders. I met so many leaders across the world, so many of them, name them. And how many of them did leave any significant impression on me? Very, very few. No one had a greater impression on me than Angela Merkel.
Now, she was one at the time when you were prime minister and she was chancellor. She was the one who kind of minted that term that became some sort of a doctrine for German-Israel policy, which is referred to as Staatsraison, the raison d'état. And she said that Israel's security
she
will always
it,
be...
I'll remind you, when I invited her to speak at the Israeli Knesset at the time that I was prime minister, and she said it in the Knesset, that one of the main basic principles for the existence of Germany is the security of the state of Israel. No German chancellor since World War II to that day said anything similar.
But
and they were friends.
She referred to it in the context of Iran, of course. And the question in which we discuss a lot in Germany is to what extent this concept, this doctrine is really filled with life and to what extent it really serves our interest and the interest of peace and the interest of Israelis. At the moment, it looks like the German political elite is very much sticking to that doctrine without really asking itself, what does it mean? Does it mean that Germany would support any Israeli government, regardless of what it's doing? So where do you see, like, you follow German...
I hope not. Look, if I don't support an Israeli government, I wouldn't expect the German government to support the Israeli government. If I think that an Israeli government is reckless, irresponsible, dangerous... to the basic national interest of Israel, why would I want an outside government, whichever, Germany or France or Austria or Sweden or Great Britain or Canada, support that same government? I think that's not expected. I expect the German government to have the courage to present the real, realistic picture of the policy of the state of Israel, to always support the state of Israel, and to be careful and to be selective about the Israeli government. Are two different things. I don't think that there can be any question about the commitment, fundamental commitment, genuine commitment, deep commitment that Germany has for the state of Israel and for the people of Israel. There can be no question about it. How will they support the Israeli government? Depending on the performance of the Israeli government. If the Israeli government is obnoxious, as it appears to be, if the Israeli government is reckless, irresponsible, not humanistic, to a degree that creates a certain question mark about the basic fundamental human values of the state of Israel as a result, then I don't expect the German government to support that government. Not punishing the state of Israel, not punishing the people of Israel. Punishing the government? Why not?
You are a former prime minister, so you know a great deal about statecraft. How do you differentiate, how do you discern supporting the people and the state from supporting the government. I think many politicians here will tell you, we don't know how to do that. So for us, loyalty support is government support.
I will, I'm ready to give a seminar to each one of your potential leaders to explain how to do it. I don't want to, I think it will be somewhat not smart, okay, not sensitive. Mm. To offer all kinds of political measures that can be made against the government as a, you know, an Israeli and a former prime minister of Israel to give another government an idea what to do against the Israeli government. Is there, believe me, I know some of you guys in the leadership. I knew them in the past. I know them in the present. They are very smart. They are very sophisticated. They need to be told what to do to distinguish between the government and the state of Israel, okay? And they will know how to take the necessary measures.
Let's go back a bit to Gaza, to the perspective of the societies, and also to the relevance of Palestine. We hear a lot here in Europe from politicians who claim that recognizing Palestine at the moment would be a reward to Hamas. And that it would not serve any goal of stabilizing the situation or supporting Palestinian independence, that it's just a symbolic move. How do you see that? What is the relevance?
Look, a two-state solution is the only solution, political solution, for the historic conflict between Israel and the Palestinians. And there is nothing which is more important for us. First of all, that needs to be understood, accepted as a basic premise for all our discussions. Palestinian state, the creation of Palestinian state, a two-state solution, Palestinian state alongside the state of Israel, is not a punishment to Israel, as it is not a bonus to the Palestinians. It is in the interest of the state of Israel to have a Palestinian state as a basis of a comprehensive solution between us and them. And the sooner, the better. We have to cease to be occupiers. We have to cease to be in military control of the millions of Palestinians that are held without human rights and civil rights and political freedom and freedom of movement and freedom of speech and whatnot. It has to change. Okay? So number one, this is something that is in the interest of the state of Israel. And if someone supports a two-state solution, he is not anti-Israeli, he is pro-Israeli. Question now is whether recognizing a state that doesn't exist is useful. Two different things. I am in favor of a Palestinian state. Do I have to ask myself whether I support what President Marz or President Macron says? I talked with President Macron, presented him with our plan, Dr. Kidboy and myself plan for two states, which is based on what I proposed to Mahmoud Abbas, president of the Palestinian Authority, when I was prime minister in 2008, and he didn't have the guts and the leadership and the depths of understanding to sign it then. But so if Germany now and France are in support of a two-state solution, they follow what I have proposed. I have only a good reason to thank them. However, question is not whether you support the creation of a Palestinian state, whether you recognize a Palestinian state which has yet not been established. This is a question which needs to be discussed and analyzed, and I'm not sure that there is a simple answer for that. I think that what needs to be done is to force the two sides to sit together and open a dialogue. Only Israel can help create a Palestinian state, because declarations coming from Europe, or from America for that matter, if they are not implemented on ground by Israel, there will not be a Palestinian state, because we occupy all their territories. And the occupation, if it will not end, there will not be a Palestinian sovereign, independent Palestinian state, as they deserve to have in exercising their self-determination. So the question is not recognizing a state. But however, having said that, I must say that I think that in the final analysis, the initiative of President Macron and together with Prime Minister Sturmer and Prime Minister Mukani, and with the tacit support of Chancellor Merz and others, was useful. Why? I think that what happened is that they started to be the only game in town. And when Trump saw that the Europeans move this together with the Saudis, the global alliance, and the vote in the General Assembly of the United Nations of a two-state solution on the Palestinian state, and 140 countries voted for it, suddenly Trump felt that he is left alone without any initiative. And he is supposed, by his own assignment, he is supposed to be the only game in town. Who are these Europeans that take from him the centrality of what happens? So I think that in a certain way, perhaps indirectly, it has forced him to take that initiative to force Netanyahu to agree the end of the war, and that suddenly restored him into the center stage of the international awareness, and he won a lot of credit for ending the war. But I think that the European initiative, in a certain way, did help push him towards it. Mm-hmm. So it had a certain positive aspect.
And Germany wasn't even part of it. It was basically the French.
Germany wasn't formally in part of it, but Germany was very much behind the scenes with the Franceses and the Canadians and the British. Chancellor Merz played the game considering the very specific sensitivities of Germany in a subtle manner, and I can't criticize him.
You mentioned that Israel cannot no longer afford the occupation, and that the occupation not only has a negative impact on the Palestinians, but also on the Israeli society.
Absolutely.
In what way do you think the international support for this is going to fade away, and what is going to be the consequence? What is going to be the consequence for the occupation?
It is fading away, and therefore, when you asked me before, how significant is the European position? It is very significant, you know, when Israelis are finding it now more and more difficult to go into different European centers, like they are attacked in Berlin, they are attacked in France, in Paris, they are attacked in London, they are attacked in Amsterdam, they are attacked in Athens, in the Greek islands, everywhere. The popular reaction to occupation is going to be to expand exponentially in a way that will make the Israelis feel very uncomfortable to go overseas, which is what Israelis love to do. Millions of Israelis, you know, almost 50% of the population are traveling every year because we are like in a very closed place. We have no neighboring countries that can be tourist sites and visiting sites for Israelis. So we have to go further. We have to go to Greece. We have to go to Italy. We have to go to France, to Germany. There are so many Israelis are flying to Berlin. It's unbelievable.
How about the United States? How do you see the development there?
And it will spread over to the United States. Look what happened now in New York. Can you imagine that a Muslim was elected mayor of the city of New York with 33% of the Jews in New York supporting him? This is exactly the margin that may have made Cuomo, the mayor of New York, had he received the 33% of the Jewish vote rather than they are going to Mamdani. And I think it's something that I knew that it was coming. I felt that it was coming, and no one would listen. I said that the day will come that the Jews in America that were in the forefront of all the civil rights and human rights and political rights battles across the world in favor of other countries will lose hope with Israel continuing to be occupants, and they will vote against us. And this is what happened now. I mean,
So for you, basically ending
many,
the occupation.
Many reasons, perhaps there may be, I don't know him. Although he quoted me a few times, Mamdani, I don't know him, never met with him. But there are good reasons, perhaps, about the city of New York, the way the city is run, the priorities of the city and the needs of the population, that maybe moved some voters towards him. But had the Jewish community been united against him, he wouldn't have been elected.
So for you, ending the occupation is a matter of national security? Because it's the only way.
National interest of Israel, national security, and also help define again what is the character of the state of Israel that we want to have. What do we want to be? A messianic occupier of territories that we believe were historically part of the heritage of the Jewish people, and maybe we are right about that, that they were part of the historic heritage and legacy of the Jewish people. But what are we after? Are we after the historic memories and prayers of the Jews for 2,000 years on territories which are now inhabited by millions of people, different people? And are we going to prioritize the prayers of the past over the fundamental human values of the present and the perspectives of the future? And what does it mean in terms of our lives, in terms of continuing inevitably terror, violence, bloodshed, wars, as it was, as it may be? Or saying, okay, we truly believe that the west part of the Jordan is part of Jewish heritage, but there are now 5 million Palestinians living there.
I mean,
do
you not
we
only
want to deny them forever the right for self-determination, or are we prepared to give up our hold in the territories for the sake of a better future?
You're not only the former prime minister of Israel, but also the former mayor of Jerusalem.
Right.
So you got a taste of historical relevance, messianic dreams, real estate prices, international interest, all of this overlapping. During the Oslo negotiations, Jerusalem was left to the end of the negotiations because the parties and the negotiators believed, okay, let's build trust first, build institutions, find a mechanism, find a framework, and then in the end we can probably talk about Jerusalem. And in the end it was something
helped. Not accurately. In this Oslo agreement, we agreed, first time in the history, we agreed to negotiate the future of Jerusalem.
You agreed to negotiate it, but not, of course.
Well, if you agree to negotiate, it means that in principle you don't rule out the option of making a compromise.
Where do you see the role of Jerusalem now? If there was a Palestinian state, if negotiations started.
Precisely what I proposed. I proposed when I was prime minister, 2008, 2009, I proposed that the Arab side of Jerusalem will be the capital of Palestine, that the Arab side will be divided, cut out from the Jewish capital, that the west part of Jerusalem will be the capital of Israel, the east part will be the capital of Palestine, and the old city of Jerusalem, I proposed for the first time, which was then sounded devastating, I'm sure it still is to so many Israelis, I say that the old city of Jerusalem should not be under any exclusive political sovereignty, neither Palestine nor Israel. And the reason is very simple. If there will be one flag over the Temple Mount, there will never be peace. Whether it will be Palestinian flag or whether it will be an Israeli flag, there should be no flag. Peace is more important than the exclusive political sovereignty and the manifestation of superiority over the sensitivity of the other side. We have to leave it to a trust that will be nominated by the UN Security Council with at least 5 nations. Dr. El-Kidwa and myself talk about Saudi Arabia, Jordan, Palestine, Israel, and America, maybe more. They will administer it, keep it available and free for all believers of the monotheistic religions, Muslims, Jews, Christians, everyone. But there will not be an exclusive political sovereignty. Why? Peace is more important. That's all.
Now you are, I believe, we are at the end of the podcast. Just one final question. You are now 80 years old, I believe, right? Is that
that's right.
Is that correct? So when you started your career, you were certainly not a leftist peacenik. You came
I'm
from
not a
very...
Lefty.
You come from a very from a Likud background, and you served as deputy prime minister to Ariel Sharon. So nobody can accuse you of being like an idealist peacemaker. You waged wars in Gaza. You you repented also. What happened to you personally that you do what you're doing now? I mean, people, some people in Israel call you a traitor. They say like you're trying to capitalize on that peace issue, get international recognition because whatever you like to be in the limelight. What you say about the government of Israel also causes some, let's say, domestic, even diplomatic issues sometimes. What is it that drives you?
My concern, my worries, my fear for the future of the state of Israel. I am not a leftist. My parents, had they lived today, most probably would have been on my side, as many of those who are still alive from the older generation of the revisionist part of the public opinion in Israel. All of the members of Likud, of my age group, that were part of the growth of the party from the first time that we won elections in 1977. I was already at my second term as member of parliament in 1977. I was a major power in the election campaign in 1977 that won the elections. And we never had the same rhetoric. We never used the same terminology. We never use the same attitudes of the messianic beliefs of hatred and violence against Palestinians and against Arabs. Menachem Begin himself, Menachem Begin, who was the symbol for all of us, he withdrew from every bit of Sinai, didn't leave one centimeter in the hands of Israel, recognized the complete sovereignty of Egypt over all of Sinai, and he never ever dared bring a vote for the annexation of the territories, which he, before being elected prime minister, said they will forever remain part of Israel. They are not the West Bank, they are Judea and Samaria. Never did anything to implement what he said because he knew that it will never happen. And so I am not that far from the traditional Likud. The Likud of today is a captive of messianic, extremist, chauvinistic, fascistic attitude of reckless, irresponsible, violent, and aggressive people that do not represent the basic fundamental values of the state of Israel. And in conclusion to our discussion, I want to say this. The reason, when you ask me what drives me, what makes me move from one corner of the world to the other, coming from Tokyo the day before yesterday to the day into Berlin, to tomorrow into Greece, and then to Canada, and then to Croatia and everywhere, I want that many more millions of people across the world will understand that the voice of Israel is not the voice of occupation, is not the voice of aggression, is not the voice of revenge, is not the voice of killing and devastation. It is a voice of compassion. It is the voice of compromise. It is the voice of responsibility. And it is the voice of peace. And my voice represents, I don't say all of the majority of Israelis, I don't know, but certainly millions of Israelis, I speak from their heart, and that's what drives me.
Prime Minister Olmert, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Epicon podcast. Epicon stands for European Palestinian Israeli Trilateral Dialogue. an initiative that creates and fosters dialogue between Palestinian and Israeli peace advocates and European opinion leaders. APICON is implemented by the Candid Foundation with the financial support of the European Union. For more information, visit the Candid website and follow us on our APICON social media accounts linked in the description.